Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry we're a little late. There was a speaker in traffic. Traffic coming to McGill? No, no way. I'm very happy that you all made it here. As you know, this is our last evening for the public forum this year. And before we move on to the program, I would like to introduce someone to you who has been key in getting this whole series on the road every year for 9 years, Annette Novak. Annette has been leading this almost on a one-to-one. In the last few years, we've been collaborating, Peter Siegel and I, with her. But if this series has become as successful as it is because of her dedication and her wanting to transmit to the patients and their families and the public in general who are interested in these topics, the latest information, bringing together the clinicians, the clinician scientists, and the scientists who work here at the Goodman Cancer Research Center, but all across a number of hospital sites, not only McGill, but also the other cancer sites in Montreal. So we couldn't have done this without you, and I thank you profoundly. That's what happened when you use a PC. You see?
Wow.
Okay. So the series this year was called Today's Research for Tomorrow's Cure, La Recherche Actuelle vers un avenir sans cancer. Last time we did something on melanoma, I remember very well. I came in with the straw hat about this size, an oversized coat, a big umbrella, and I stood there presenting. I wasn't going to get one ray of sunshine. Today, we skipped from winter to summer in one day, and we're going back to spring. So you have an opportunity to learn about what you need to do, why you need to do it, why melanoma is such an important disease to treat. And I hope that our speakers tonight will also be able to give you the sense of melanoma is now at the forefront of major diseases that are being treated with novel treatments, personalized treatments, and immunotherapy. And so whatever happens in melanoma, whatever is the success in melanoma, then essentially moves to other cancers. So it is important to understand what is going on because it sort of cascades down to the other cancer diseases. So I'm very pleased to present to you tonight mole versus melanoma. Can you spot the difference? Un grain de beauté ou mélanome? Sauriez-vous les distinguer? I just remind you that questions you will be getting, you've gotten cue cards and pencils, and if you have questions, please write them on your cue cards. They'll be brought down at the end, and we'll have one question period at the end for all speakers. So, who am I? I'm Nicole Beauchemin. I live here. Except I moved last week for the first time in 38 years, and I'm hurting all over. I've been doing this for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it. And I'm going to continue next year. Our first speaker tonight is a clinician scientist, Dr. Leon Van Kempen. Dr. Van Kempen started out his career studying molecular biology and biochemistry at Radboud University in Nijmegen. Not that, in the Netherlands, where he did his PhD program. During his PhD program, he also trained at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia. Then he went back to the Netherlands, completed his MD and specialty in pathology, and decided that he would focus on certain diseases related to melanoma, looking at the tumor environment. So he then moved to the University of California in San Francisco, where he studied the topic of tumor environment. He went back to the Netherlands as an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology and was at the University Medical Center there for a number of years. In 2010, he was recruited to the Department of Pathology, and he's been instrumental in helping to build the Molecular Pathology Center at the Jewish General. He's the chief operating officer there and has been since 2013, and he's now a professor, an assistant professor in the Department of Pathology at McGill University. So it's my pleasure to introduce Leon Van Kempen.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Welcome. What I'm planning to do this evening in about 20 minutes, I hope, is to give you an introduction into melanoma. An introduction with a pathology angle, trying to understand what do we see from the surface and what can't we see? What can we actually measure that will help us treat melanoma patients better? And I think my first slide is showing you basically the problem that we have or the problem that we faced is that from the top, what is being exposed by the sun, we can easily see, but we could not see what's underneath. And recent research, in which I will point you to, has shown us much more information on how these melanomas grow and how we can use those mechanisms to actually start treating those melanomas much better than we've used to. We cannot talk about melanoma without talking about skin. So what you'll see here is a cartoon of skin. Skin is our largest organ that we have. It's a very complex organ, and I think it's one of the most beautiful organs because you have so many different substructures in there. What you can see here is a cut-through where you have, this is your cornified layer. These are your hairs. Your hairs dive into an element that we call the dermis. And on top of the dermis is a layer of cells that forms your actual skin. Right? If you fall and scratch and you have a scratch wound that's not bleeding, the only thing that happened is you scraped off the top of your skin. Once you fall hard or you take a knife and you cut yourself, then the knife goes through into the dermis, cuts the vessels, and only then you will start to bleed. So you'll have different layers that make the skin a very complex and intriguing one. What we're going to talk about is melanoma and melanocytes. Now, what are these melanocytes? Melanocytes are cells that actually form pigment. And the pigment is called melanin. And that melanin gives color to your skin, your hair, your eyes. Melanin is being produced by a cell called the melanocyte. And the melanocyte is an intriguing cell that is surrounded by a lot of keratinocytes. We call these cells in the epidermis, so the top layer of your cell, of your skin, those are called keratinocytes, and they're intermixed with melanocytes, and the melanocytes have long dendrites. What melanocytes do is they produce the pigment and spread them around the skin so that not only the cell that produces the pigment, but also its neighboring cells can take up that pigment and become colored. This is what it looks like in real life in a pathology image. So this, again, is your keratinocytes here that I wrote here. These are the keratinocytes. The top of the skin is in this area. This is the bottom of the skin, and this is your dermal component. And this is the border that separates the keratinocytes from the dermal skin. Now, the melanocytes, you can see them here. I think this is a very nice picture. You see here, this is a dark brown cell, and you have these protrusions. You have these long, it's like an octopus. They stick out at tangles and move in between the different cells and deposit their pigment over there. And it's not just that the cells are taking up this brown pigment. The cells take up this brown pigment and use them as an umbrella or as a hat, which you can clearly see here. So every cell has a nucleus, and the nucleus is where the DNA is stored. And DNA is very susceptible to UV damage. UV damage, which is the major culprit of sunlight. In order to protect the DNA, those cells accumulate that melanin and put it on top of the nucleus. And what you see here is that every nucleus has a hat, basically, of melanin, and that the sun that comes down from here to here cannot breach the melanin and cannot reach the DNA. And therefore, the DNA is being protected. This is also the reason why when you sit in the sun, you tan, because those melanocytes respond to sunlight, to UV irradiation. And what they do immediately is produce melanocytes and spread them along the neighbors, and that's how you get brown. Also, when those cells, they're not stuck there. They move upwards, right? So they grow from the bottom up to the outside. So when you are losing your skin after a suntan, you'll see that your skin is, actually skin that you can peel off, is sometimes actually brown. That's actually the melanin that you're peeling off from your skin that has been produced by the melanocytes in response to to the sunlight. So melanin is actually a very natural and very good sunscreen. Now, we don't have the same skin color. Skin color is very variable. You have the very redheads from Ireland towards the blonde blue eyes from Northern Europe, the people from Spain, and then you go downwards towards the equator and people become darker and darker. This has nothing to do with a person having more melanocytes, having more cells that make the pigment. Those cells are much better adapted to crank out a whole lot of melanin and spread them around the neighboring keratinocytes to protect these cells from these higher levels of UV radiation that that you're exposed to the closer you live to the equator. Now, in this picture is a histology picture of, and I hope the detail is good for you on that screen, is a histological picture of a freckle. A freckle is not a mole. Right? A freckle, which you can see here, is pigmentation of the lower level of the keratinocytes in the skin. It's usually pale brown, and what makes this different from a mole is that as soon as you're no longer exposed to sunlight, it disappears. So freckles usually occur in summer or in spring, like this weather today. Then it's spread around on the bottom layer, protecting those cells. A mole, or how we call it an avis, is a bit different. A mole is a cluster of melanocytes. So in the top, the melanocytes are not enriched. They produce more melanin and spread around. In a mole, you have more melanocytes producing pigment. But because you have more, those moles are usually darker. They appear darker. And depending on how deep those nevus cells are in your skin, your nevus become light, can be very light or sometimes bluish, and then we're talking about the blue nevus, actually. Or when they are very superficial or they are mixed with the epidermis, you have a very brown lesion. And these are long-lasting. Most of them are there already at birth. The average adult has about 10 to 40 of those, and sometimes they regress. Sometimes they disappear. And they disappear usually with age. Now, UV damage. UV damage, when UV is exposed, when skin is exposed to high levels of UV, you can induce DNA damage. DNA damage is irrespective of the cell type. The radiation doesn't care if it hits a melanocyte or it hits a keratinocyte. And therefore, you can get two different tumors. You have tumors of the keratinocytes, which are called, for which in skin we have two. We have the basal cell carcinoma and the squamous cell carcinoma. And when the UV creates a lot of damage in the melanocytes, you can induce a melanoma. A melanoma is a tumor of the melanocytes, and usually very pigmented. Melanoma is not a very frequent disease if you compare it to any other tumors, and especially to other tumors that can arise in the skin, like basal and cell carcinoma. These are numbers from 2013. For basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma combined, there were about 3,500 cases per 100,000 people. Right? But most of them are very curable. Most people do not die from a basal or squamous cell carcinoma. For melanoma, it's a completely different story. The incidence is much lower. In 2010, it's approximately 50 cases per 100,000 patients. And what you see here, what I will not go into detail, is that it really makes a difference whether you're male or female. Males, incidence in males is much higher, and survival in females is much better. But that's going to be a topic for a next lecture. That said, the incidence of melanoma is rare compared to carcinomas of the skin. Now, how do we go from mole to cutaneous melanoma? And I'm only going to focus on cutaneous melanoma. We have other types of melanoma too. Melanomas that arise in areas where the sun doesn't shine. You can have melanomas in brain, so leptomeningeal melanomas. You can have melanomas in the mucosa in, meaning in the you can have them in the mouth, you can have it in the penile area, the vulvar area. They can occur everywhere. Here, I'm only focusing on melanomas that arise on the skin. The etiology or the way melanomas develop in other sites is different. So in skin, if you are one of the things you have to be aware of, if you see, if you're wondering, is my nevus or is this spot in my skin a melanoma or not, is the very easy ABCDE rule. Right? E stands for asymmetry. Is your lesion very symmetric? It's probably benign. B stands for border. If your border is very circumscribed, then it's most likely benign. C is for color. Is your lesion uniform in color? It's most likely benign. D is for diameter. Is the diameter larger than 2-3 millimeters? If it's smaller than that, it's probably benign. And the most important thing is evolution. Does your lesion change over time? That's the most important thing. And that's E for evolution. So A, B, C, D, E, I think if you want to take one thing home, the A, B, C, D, E rule should be applied. You know, it's like a rule that everybody should remember. And on skin, it looks like this. So normal skin, you have no spot. Nevus, you have a small, equally stained, brown, nicely circumscribed, small lesion with a small diameter. A dysplastic nevus becomes a bit bigger, the border becomes irregular, melanoma in situ, it's absolutely irregular in border, irregular in color, and invasive melanoma is a lesion that is indicated here. Now, cartoon-wise, here again, this is the epidermis. Epidermis, the keratinocytes, the dermis, and the melanocytes are in here. In normal skin, your melanocytes are interspersed with your keratinocytes. In a nevus, you have more of those, right? You have more in the epidermis, and you have more in the dermis. A dysplastic nevus, or an atypical nevus, is you have more of them. They behave funny, but they not all meet the criteria of saying this is a malignant lesion. Melanoma in situ is different. Melanoma in situ has all the attributes of being a malignant lesion, but it is kept within the epidermal component. So it's kept within the layer of keratinocytes. It has not breached into the dermal component. A melanoma, when we talk about invasive melanoma, then the lesion has breached that layer and is now invading the tissue. Now, this is how it looks like in real life. Melanomas, to be deadly, can be scarily small. To indicate here, this is the bar, this is 3 millimeters. So this area is 3 millimeters. This is a melanoma, so in real life, it's 6 millimeters wide. A lesion of 6 millimeters that can be very deadly. Here you have examples and different magnification of how these lesions look like. And here again, this here we have the melanoma in situ in this case. And see again, here it starts to color brown very prominently. Now, in pathology, historically, we have grouped all cutaneous melanoma as one. Right? They grew in, had an epidermal component, so something was growing in the top layer of the skin. They had a dermal component, and they behaved weird. They looked weird. They were looking absolutely not normal, and we grouped them as superficial spreading melanoma of the skin. But there's more than meets the eye, because some are more equal than other. What we can see, or how we try to classify melanomas about, I think it's five years ago, is completely changing. Because now we know we have to look deeper. You know, melanoma, we have to look more than skin deep. So what happens now in those melanomas? As I said, DNA is very susceptible to UV damage. UV changes, or can induce, changes in DNA, which we're referring to as mutations. This DNA is a blueprint. It's a blueprint for all the molecules that your cell need to survive. And you compare that to Lego bricks. Lego bricks, they're absolutely defined what the diameters of those Lego bricks are. If it's off by 1 millimeter, or the two positions are not 3.2 millimeters aside, the bricks don't fit anymore. And this is what a mutation in DNA does to the protein that it encodes for. If there is a mutation, it changes the structure of the molecule, of the protein, and it does not behave the way it should behave. It can be completely non-functional, that it's not responding to anything at all, or it can become super, super activated. Now, and the selection of DNA mutation over time, this is what's causing tumors to grow haywire. Now, due to the UV exposure, cutaneous melanoma contains the most DNA mutations of every tumor you can think of, because it's so much on the surface and it's hit by UV light every time you walk out the door. These are the building blocks. We don't say a building block like, you know, the long red with six dots or the blue one with four dots. We give them names. The names refer here to as genes. So the genes that are frequently mutated in melanoma are listed here. And there are a whole lot. And there's a whole lot because the cells suffer a lot of UV damage. Now the question is, which one is important? Which mutation that is induced or that makes the tumor grow is responsible? And can we use actually to drive therapies against those melanomas? So we have the BRAFs, the NRAS, the NF1s, and a whole lot of molecules that I even don't know they existed, and let alone know what they're doing. Now, we do know a little bit, and I think this is the most complicated picture that I have, and that is that even though we have a lot of building blocks, we know how they assemble. We know which block talks to another block and how they form a structure. So, for example, here's your, one of the molecules I mentioned. This is BRAF. This is a molecule I mentioned. It's NRAS and NF1. It's not that a cell has a lot of proteins and by chance something happens. No, it's a very orchestrated system in which the activity of one protein drives the activity of another protein. So if one protein is wrong, you're miswiring this whole system. Right? So anything that is aberrant here will affect the proliferation of the cells. And this knowledge, knowing the type of mutations that we have discovered by basic research, has led to a reclassification of cutaneous melanoma. It's now not that we group all the melanomas together saying this is a superficial spreading melanoma of the skin. We can now actually discriminate them and tell them, provide the treating physician with a bit more information on the mutation may mean. So in this small picture, we have five different types of melanoma. This is a melanoma on the back of the skin. This is without chronic sun damage, because most people wear clothes and cover the back of the skin. These melanomas are frequently harboring mutations in these building blocks, in these genes, BRAF and NRAS. And you see here that depending on the tumor, whether it grows on skin that has chronic sun damage, that arises on mucosal surface, for example, in the mouth, that rises on aqueous surfaces, so the hairless, so that your palm of your hand, the foot of your, the sole of your foot, or even in the eye, they have a completely different mutation profile. And what Dr. Watson will talk about, I think, and what he was absolutely instrumental to, is that his research, or the team that he worked with, has led to an identification of four molecular classes of melanoma. A melanoma that has a mutation in the building block called BRAF, or NRAS, or NF1, or does not have a mutation in any of those three. It doesn't mean it doesn't have any mutations at all. It just doesn't have a mutation in BRAF, NRAS, or NF1. So basically, with these three genes, we can capture, we know that this pathway is this network of interactions is completely altered, but we know what the cause of that alteration is. And because we know what the cause of the alteration is, we are now much more better and able to specifically target and provide precision medicine for melanoma patients. Also, what we learned is that these specific mutations are associated with sun exposure and anatomical localization. It really matters where the melanoma arises and what molecular subtype it entails. So chronic sun exposure, incidence increases with age, right? And that's due to the accumulation of mutations. In non-chronic sun exposure, the peak is around age of 50 and are mostly characterized by mutation in the building block BRAF, and V600E is basically the way we name a molecule when there is a specific mutation. So BRAF V600E is the bad form in melanoma. Now, the take-home message of this very short introduction into melanoma is that you can have a variety of melanoma subtypes, either anatomical, you know, where does it grow, histological, and more important, molecular. And our understanding of the molecular pathways has resulted in effective therapies that Dr. Mihalciu will talk to you about in a minute. And our continuous research into the mechanism by which these tumors arise is changing the way we diagnose melanoma. And the molecular diagnosis of melanoma trumps the histological diagnosis for treatment options. With this, I would like to thank you and like to give back to it to you.
PCs. Okay, so you know a little bit more about what causes it, and unfortunately, patients who come down with the disease need to be treated. So you would presume that if they have different mutations, maybe they need to be treated differently. And there's an old way of treating them and a new way of treating them. So our next speaker is a physician. He's well known in the McGill community. He has been treating patients for some time. He's assistant professor of medicine and oncology at McGill University and at the MUHC, and he's co-director of the clinical research program and co-director of the Oncology Day Center at the MUHC. It's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Catalin Mihalciu.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. These are my conflict of interest. So I'm going to focus on my presentation more on challenges that we have to face in the clinic and why our effort to really cure cancer was not so effective for the last 50 years. I'll show a few trends and solutions the way I see them, and I will conclude with some new progress that we made by using immune oncology. So what are the challenges? The main one is tumor heterogeneity. And there are different types of heterogeneity. There is heterogeneity from one patient to another who has the same type of cancer, the same stage, but when you do the molecular signature, they don't look the same. Or you can have patients that have multiple tumor, like in metastatic setting, but if you do the molecular signature, the tumors are not, they have the same signature. And then the most challenging one is intratumoral heterogeneity. This is a new concept that is evolving, and I'm going to elaborate more on this one. Why is it important, intratumoral heterogeneity? Because it's going to help us to stratify the patients based on subclonal emergence during the evolution of the tumor. Also, will be a tool to trace down tumor evolution, and in this way, maybe we can find some ways to prevent tumor to occur. And also, it will offer us some experimental models for future clinical trials, and then really will help us with precision medicine. Because until now, we are talking about precision medicine, but I think we are far from there. We are probably doing some stratification medicine and personalized medicine. When we'll be talking in the future about precision medicine, probably we'll be talking about curability. So several types of intratumoral heterogeneity. This is an example of temporal heterogeneity. So what you see here is if you diagnose a tumor here, you have maybe one emergent clone, malignant clone, but as the tumor is growing, subclones will evolve. And then if the tumor is diagnosed at this point, so you have a driver clone mutation plus subclones that will be associated with a poor outcome down the road. Spatial heterogeneity. If you do a cut through a tumor in different areas and you take sections from or samples from different areas, you notice that you have different groups of tumor cells that have different molecular signature and they have different oncogenic pathway that have to be addressed in a different way. And some pathways are easy to be targeted, some pathways, oncogenic pathway will be more difficult to be targeted, and then maybe we have to look at other ways how to manipulate those cells. Also, we can see heterogeneity from the driver mutation point of view. So they have different association of gene mutation that will induce a different type of oncogenic pathway that will be dominant for a group of cells or for one cell. And this is an example that in the center you have a tumor or a tumor cell or a group of tumor cells, and they have a very intricate interaction with the microenvironment, and few cells or one cell can have a different propensity for attracting angiogenicity or for motility, and you have other groups of cells that have a different interaction with the immune system or a different way to adjust to hypoxia, for instance. So I'll show you a few slides about genomic heterogeneity. If you do gene sequencing in 10 patients, you can get this kind of analysis. You can have a blue line, which represents the ubiquitous or what is called the truncal mutations, which are common in all the tumor cells. And then in yellow, you can have only selected specific mutations that are common only in some subgroups of cells. And then you have in red private mutations that are specific only for one cell or a small group of cells. So as you can see here, you have different types of distribution of these types of mutations. I would suggest to look between patient number one and the last patient number 10. Personally, I would prefer to be in group one rather than group 10. Here you have a long truncal mutation, which is much easier to deal with, and very few private mutations here. In this patient, you have a very short truncal mutation, but many private mutations, so you have a lot of heterogeneity that you have to deal with in parallel when you treat this patient. So molecular signatures in the future is going to, looking at the tumor cells, is going to give us a glimpse of how we are going to approach the patient based on this kind of distribution of gene mutations. So the comparison is with a tree, the truncal mutation, the branch mutations, and the leaves are the private mutations. So if you have a tree like this, with this kind of distribution, the risk is much lower for treatment failure versus this kind of tree that will be much more difficult to treat because you have in parallel clones or subclones with different molecular signatures that you have to treat them in parallel. And that's a study that was done looking at the absence or the presence of subclonal drivers, and if you don't have a subclonal driver, your survival is better. So tumor plasticity is the next challenge, and these are some examples of tumor plasticity. I will start with epithelial mesenchymal phenotype because that's the most challenging one. You see here tumor cells, nucleus in blue, the tumor cell, the cytoplasm in green, and you have in red cell adhesion molecules. But here you see cell that is losing these cell adhesion molecules and starts migrating. And this happens at the interface between between the tumor periphery and the microenvironment. This is where all the conversation between the tumor and the microenvironment is taking place. And we can see an example of epithelial mesenchymal transition in vitro. So you have the cells grouped here all together. They are attached through cell adhesion molecules, and they can go back and forth from epithelial into the mesenchymal phenotype by losing these adhesion molecules. And how does it happen? Well, through different selective pressures from the microenvironment, hypoxia, oncogenic activation, different genes that put pressure on the tumor cells, inflammation from the stroma. You have upregulation of the EMT master genes, which are depicted here. And then you have EMT transformation or transformation into a stem cell. You can have this type of EMT transformation either in embryogenesis, has been described in neural crest, which is when it starts migrating. They developed upregulation of the EMT master genes and then allows them to migrate. But also we see that in wound healing, as you can see here, epithelial cells here, they are tightly attached, but in order to participate in the wound healing, they undergo mesenchymal transformation, as you can see here, and that's a normal process. In oncology, in cancer cells, we have this EMT process back and forth. Tumor cells at the periphery of the tumor in conversation with the microenvironment, they can get different degree of EMT transition and into the mesenchymal phenotype, and then they can go back into an epithelial phenotype, and I will have a slide that will exemplify that better. Another example of tumor plasticity is protective adaptive response. In vitro study, you have cells here in a petri dish attached to the extracellular matrix. If you come with a targeted therapy, you have destruction of the tumor cells in the center, but in the periphery, the cells attached to the extracellular matrix, they have induction of rescue signal with upregulation of specific genes that I mentioned here, and this gives them a survival edge. And finally, dynamic reciprocity, that's a process of communication between tumor cells and microenvironment. It has been described by Peter Friedel from Holland, from Amsterdam. How does it work? The process is like a DNA helix. There is a sequential conversation between tumor cell with different compartments in the microenvironment, and they change through this conversation each other. At some point, it changes the tumor as well, and then the tumor continues to have conversation like in a spiral. And at some point, the tumor becomes independent, doesn't need any conversation with the microenvironment, and this is a point of no return. That's an example of how the conversation takes place. You can have migration of the tumor cells. This is at the interface with microenvironment. You can have collective migration. You can have in small groups migration, or you can have single cell migration, as it, you can see depicted here. And finally, the last challenge that I'm going to talk about is the tumor dormancy or immortality. So dormancy is a way of escaping death for the tumor. And basically what it does, it goes into autophagy, so it kind of form of senescence. It starts eating its own protein, shrinks, sends the signal, the immune system might see the tumor that tumor cell that is going into senescence, and it let it be because it will send the macrophages to come to eliminate the debris, but it stopped before going into complete apoptosis and stay dormant into a niche, and it can stay dormant forever. I can usually what happens is every patient that had invasive tumor, they always have dormancy somewhere, but the tumor will not bounce back and the patient may remain in remission for forever. But if the niche receives the wrong signal from the microenvironment, then it will tell the tumor cell to which is in dormancy or like a stem cell, to go into asymmetric division, and this is when you have a recurrence. So that's one form of immortality. There is another form of immortality when you regress into a young form, like a stem cell. I will show you some examples from nature, and this is one of them, a jellyfish that is immortal. And why is immortal? Because it can, from an adult a sexual developed form, can regress into a polyform, which is an early form of development, if the condition in the pH or the nutrition or the temperature of the water changes. In order to survive, regress into a young form, and then when the conditions are better, then it can bounce back into an adult form. So that's an example of immortality. And for women, they have a lot of fetal stem cells that are transferred through the placenta, and they remain dormant in the mother. And for women who had male offspring, you can identify the Y chromosome 30 to 40 years after the delivery. And that's an example in the thyroid, in the spleen, in the liver. You can see the Y chromosome in a female. So that's the only way it can get there. So next, what are the solutions? I mentioned here about focusing on the tumor cell. We can focus on microenvironment, which is much more efficient, in my opinion, because this is a losing game by trying to kill all the tumor cells. It will never happen, and if it happens, then you kill the host as well. I'm not going to talk about precision medicine because we don't have enough time. So CRISPR technology is a new technology that is evolving now, and you can reset in a controlled way the tumor DNA. Another way is to do liquid biopsies, and liquid biopsies refer to collecting the circulating tumor cells from the peripheral blood in neoadjuvant, adjuvant, or metastatic setting. And why it makes sense to look at the liquid biopsy at this compartment, you have the primary lesion here, is shedding tumor cells into the circulation, and you have different types of tumor cells. You have tumor cells in proliferative gear that are ready to give a metastatic lesion. You have tumor cells that evolve as they transform into EMT, epithelial mesenchymal transformed cells, and that's the way they travel into the circulation, is a better way of survival. And then they go into a target tissue, and then they retransform into an epithelial cells and give rise to metastatic disease. But there are other EMT cells that they go into dormancy, as I mentioned about before. So in the past, in the recent past, we spent a lot of effort trying to collect CTCs, and there is a FDA-approved instrument. It's called Cell Search. The problem is that with that instrument, you can collect only 5, 10, maybe 100 cells at the most. So here at McGill, in Dr. Richard Scremer's lab, we came with the idea to collect large number of circulating tumor cells through apheresis, and that's the steps of the analysis. We do apheresis with this machine. Initially, we do a screening to see if there are tumor cells in the peripheral blood. Then we do the apheresis, and then we do cell sorting through FACS. We use different antibodies to separate the hematopoietic cells versus epithelial cells, and then we go deeper into separating subclones of cells in this way. Then we isolate the cells, we put them in culture, and then we do single cell analysis gene sequencing. That's an example of circulating tumor cells from a patient. That's an example how we separate the cells from the hematopoietic cells here. And then we put the cells in culture and they grow in mammospheres. And through immunofluorescence, the blue is for the nucleus, the green is cytokeratin, so that's a proof for an epithelial cell that has no place to be in the circulation. In red is a marker for stem cells, and then we superimpose all these colors to prove that this is the cell of interest with these characteristics. That's another example of the same thing. Now, focusing on microenvironment, in my opinion, it's a much more effective way of controlling the tumor. And we've done that with different agents. That's an example was using aromatase inhibitor. Aromatase inhibitor versus tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is an agent that blocks the estrogen receptor in breast cancer patients. On the tumor cell, aromatase inhibitor is an inhibitor of an enzyme called aromatase that is in the soft tissue, and by blocking these enzymes, we block the transformation of steroid hormones into estrogen hormones, so it has nothing to do with the tumor. You just change the microenvironment. And by doing so, you have a significant difference between tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors in terms of disease-free survival. And also preventing the contralateral breast cancer occurrence. Another way to address a microenvironment is to modulate, to block the osteoclast. Osteoclast is a cell in the bone marrow that is working parallel with the tumor cell. They are they work hand in hand, because the osteoclast is eating the bone and creating space for the tumor cell to grow, produces lots of cytokine, chemokine that are very conducive for stimulating the tumor cell to grow there. So by blocking the osteoclast, we have evidence now that you can have benefit in disease-free survival in patients with breast cancer in long term, because what you have in the bone marrow are dormant cells, and when you have a recurrence after 5 years, it's a recurrence from dormancy. So if you manipulate the niche where the tumor cell stays in dormancy, then you prevent those late recurrence. And that's a proof of this kind of concept. If you want to be more specific, in lung cancer, for instance, if you select the patients based on osteoclastic activity by measuring entelopeptide, then you have much better stratification and much more precision in who is going to benefit and will have an impact in terms of survival by using an inhibitor of osteoclastic activity. So the rest of the talk I'll focus on immune oncology, because this is where more recently we made a breakthrough. And in the last 5 years, at least in melanoma, we changed the standard of care every year. So I'll talk a little bit about general concepts of immune oncology so you can understand how it works. And then I'll explain to you who are the players, how does it work, what is the clinical evidence, patterns of response, and what is the toxicity. So because of this new concept, in the future we're going to separate the or classify the tumor based on their immunogenicity. So if you have tumors that have point mutations versus gene amplification, if you have a point mutation, means that you have a gene that is mutated that is producing an abnormal protein, and then abnormal protein will increase the chance that the immune system is going to see it. So you'll have a reaction from the immune system. If you have gene amplification means that you have a normal gene with multiple copies that is producing a normal protein, that the immune system is not going to react to it. So this is how you are going to discriminate what kind of therapy you'll start with based on the immune profile of the tumor. So the basics for immune system, we have the innate immunity, which is the first one to develop phylogenetically. It's immediate, is the first line of defense, and does not require antigen-specific response. In contrast, you have the adaptive immunity, which is slow. It takes weeks until it will develop, is antigen-specific, and you build a memory. And when we talk about immune oncology, we will refer for now only at T cell. These are the cells that become cytotoxic against the tumor cells if you provide them with the right antigen. So the T cell is in the center of attention for immune oncology. On the other, on your left side, you have an example for melanoma of targeted therapy with BRAF inhibitor and MEK inhibitor, which is very effective. But the problem always will be resistance. So it works very well, but at some point the tumor will develop a mechanism to bypass the blockade. In contrast to immunotherapy, once you develop memory on the T cell, the memory will stay there and it will, it's going to survey for the tumor recurrence all the time or most of the time. So the way the immune system is organized, you have on your left, you have receptors for T cell activation. And on your right, you have receptors that inhibit the activation. So the way we have been designed for the immune system is in a very balanced way. On one hand, you have a lot of receptors to activate and modulate the activation based on the amount of antigen. But on the other hand, you have receptors that block the activation because we have to protect ourselves from cell destruction. Autoimmune disease is self-destruction. The players that I'm going to talk about is CTLA-4 and PD-1. And how does it work? CTLA-4 works at the interface between the dendritic cell, which is the antigen-presenting cell. Usually takes place in the lymph node. The PD-1 inhibitor is at the interface between the activated tumor T cell and tumor cell. So two different sides of the way they work. So CTLA-4 is called ipilimumab, CTLA-4 inhibitor. How does it work? You have the dendritic cells here. Presents the antigen to the T cell. T cell is activated. In parallel, you have two other receptors that are coupling together to induce acceleration of the activation. So you need an acceleration of the activation of the T cell. But after 48 hours, you have another receptor that is being expressed. It's called CTLA-4, and this receptor is blocking the acceleration because you want to modulate the amount of T cell acceleration in accordance to the amount of antigen presentation. So in this way to avoid autoimmune disease. So a monoclonal antibody has been developed to block this receptor. And this is the evidence of the clinical study that showed that the top curve is ipilimumab, which shows a benefit compared with the standard of care. But what is more important is the patients who are alive and responded to this kind of intervention, they are alive at 10 years. So we are talking about curability for the first time in stage 4 cancer. The other molecule is PD-1. PD-1 is expressed on the activated T cell, and when a T cell activated is coming in contact with the tumor cell is expressing a ligand trying to activate the PD-1 receptor on the T cell, and this is programmed cell death. So that's a way of tumor cell to protect itself from the T cell attack. So they developed a monoclonal antibody that comes here and blocks and prevents the ligand from here to come and destroy the activated T cell. And this is the clinical data that shows benefit with a much more higher response rate, 75% overall survival at 1 year for the patients on PD-1 inhibitor. That's a combination. That's a type of different response rate, types of patterns of response with immunotherapy. You have the classical response when, like chemotherapy, when you apply the agent and then you have immediate response. The usual response is a gradual, slow, steady decline of the tumor cell, but you can have also a pseudo progression. When you see increase in the size of the targeted lesion, but the increase is due to massive infiltration with immune cells into the tumor, and you do a CT scan, you see a larger tumor, but the patient is feeling very well, and in a few months later, everything will disappear. The first pattern of response is the patient responds steadily, but at some point they have a new target lesion. But if you continue the treatment, even that new target lesion is decreasing in size, and this is an example of different toxicity. The toxicity is autoimmune induced, has nothing to do with the treatment that you give. It's a monoclonal antibody that primes the immune system. Toxicity you have is autoimmune, is your immune system that is attacking different organs, is the skin, the liver, the GI tract, and endocrine system, CNS, and also, you can have the lung toxicity as well. So I'm going to stop here because I'm over time. Questions will be at the end, I understand.
Okay, so thank you, Kathleen. Our next speaker is Dr. Ian Watson. Ian was recruited to the Goodman Cancer Research Center in 2015. He completed his PhD at the University of Toronto. Yeah. He then went south to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he was a visiting scientist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard University. So he stayed in Boston in 2010 and 11. But then with his supervisor, he actually moved south again. And he went to MD Anderson Cancer Center, where he stayed for 3 years, doing seminal work that he'll be talking to you about tonight. He holds a Canadian research chair on functional genomics in melanoma. He's the recipient of a Melanoma Research Alliance Young Investigator Award and a V Foundation Research Award. And he was, importantly, a co-chair of the Melanoma Cancer Genome Atlas Project. That sounds like a big thing. It is a big thing. These people get together all over the world, and they essentially pool a lot of information, in this case coming from the genes affecting melanoma patients, the immune system affecting melanoma patients, and they integrate all this data, and they sort of talk by computer all over the world, and they come up with these huge papers. There was, 300 authors on the paper, and Ian was the lead author on this. So he's a star, essentially. But he's young, so he's going to be doing a lot of other things. And in the meantime, since arriving in Montreal in 2015, he set up a melanoma network here in Montreal, but now Montreal was too small. So now he's going on all sides, and he's getting together all researchers and clinicians in Canada working together on melanoma. So he'll tell you all about this work. Welcome, Ian.
So thank you. Nicole is like my scientific mother, so she elaborated and boasted a little bit too much, but thank you so much, Nicole. I appreciate that. So you all should be molecular biologist experts now. And what the goal of my presentation today is to illustrate how basic science research has revolutionized patient care for melanoma patients. And one of the things I wanted to do is go into the basic genetics of cancer and melanoma and really provide the history of how targeted therapies were developed, how immune therapies were developed, kind of touching upon some of the descriptions that Catlin had in the first presentation. And really what I want to touch on is provide some vignettes of what the research community is doing now and why it's important to support basic science research. So, a concept that I would like to get across tonight: cancer is a genetic disease. So what do I mean by that? Well, cells are the building blocks of life. We are all made up of cells. All our tissues are made up of cells. Within our cells, we have these compartments called nucleus, a nucleus. Within the nucleus, we have our chromosomes. And within what these chromosomes are actually compact forms of DNA. And the DNA encodes for all the proteins that are important for normal cellular function. And so these are the workhorse of the cell, these proteins. Now, you can get a variety of mutations in genes, and these mutations can occur just by chance. They can occur by exposure to carcinogens, such as UV radiation in the case of melanoma. And the types of mutations you can get are, for example, deletions. So you can lose portions of your genome. And this will result in a lack of expression of your protein and abnormal cellular function. You can also have cases where you have increased copy numbers of your genes. So you have, rather than having two copies, one from your mother, one from your father, you can have multiple. And there you'll produce multiple proteins. And again, this will result in abnormal cellular function of your cells. And finally, the most common mutations that occur are single base pair changes in your DNA. So here's a little cartoon where you can see just the base pair change in your DNA. This will result in a change in the protein function, which again will result in abnormal cellular function. Now, I keep talking about these abnormal cellular functions. What do I mean by that? Well, cancer researchers have been studying for a very long time what mutations in genes do to affect cells. And we've categorized it, and probably the best person to categorize this is Drs. Hanahan and Weinberg, who have written The Hallmarks of Cancer. And what they've compiled for the research community, helped frame in the research community, is all the different processes of normal cells that change that allow a normal cell to become a cancer cell. And there's quite a few, and they keep expanding. So this is just a picture of the tumor and the surrounding cells within the tumor, and there are multiple hallmarks of these different types of cancers. And I'll just explain a few. One is they resist cell death. So now your normal cells will no longer die. They will gain immortality. They will increase proliferation, constantly proliferate. And they will gain the ability to spread to distant organs, the technical term being metastasis. They also avoid immune destruction. So when you have these mutations in your genes, turns your normal cell to a cancer cell, and they gain these properties that allow them to form a tumor. So how did we discover the mutations in melanoma? Well, again, I would like to provide a little bit of history on how these findings were made. So One particular group I would like to highlight is from the Wellcome Trust Institute, Dr. Michael Stratton and Dr. Andy Futrill. I had the great pleasure of working with Dr. Futrill when I was at MD Anderson Cancer Center. And what they propose to do is sequence a set of genes that are druggable to see if they're mutating in cancer. So this was just a fishing exercise to see if they could find these genes. It was a really expensive project, and if you look at it in terms of the technology we have today, it was like if we were comparing it to transportation, it would be like riding a tricycle. But this is all the technology allowed at the time. And there you could sequence the normal DNA, you could sequence the tumor DNA, and you could find within these druggable genes, which encode for proteins, potential mutations that can be targeted. And they actually revealed some very, very insightful information. And again, these are basic geneticists that did this work, and they found that over 50% of melanomas, and they didn't even have access to tissue, so these were cell lines, had mutations in a gene called BRAF. And again, this was a mutation where you had the single base pair change that resulted in a change in the protein, and it was druggable. So the next step, and again, this was discovered in 2002, the next step was to determine whether or not these mutations were even functional. So what a number of scientists did, and particular one, who's actually at McGill University now, David Dancourt, he generated a mouse where he actually introduced this specific BRAF mutation, and what he found was that he could induce tanning of these mice, the development of increased nevi, and actually metastatic melanoma. So that showed that this gene was important and that it could form melanoma. During the course of these studies, a number of academic and institutions, as well as industry, developed ways to drug this particular gene. And that's what they did, and they developed BRAF inhibitors, which Dr. Mihalciu briefly touched on. And when they gave this drug to patients, it was amazing. I mean, the tumors were melting off these patients, having amazing responses to drugs. But one of the challenges you can see in the survival curves, so for example, this is the progression-free survival, and you can see that it's extending when patients are giving the BRAF inhibitor compared to the chemotherapy. But when you look at the overall survival curves, you can see that eventually the patients that are given this targeted therapy develop resistance to the drug. And that's been an incredible challenge for the melanoma community. In any case, this was an example of where you performed sequencing studies, found the genetic causes, developed a drug, and still this drug's now available for patients in the clinic. So the third part of my talk that I'd like to address was, how were the immune therapies developed? How was this done? Well, as I mentioned, one of the hallmarks of cancers, one of the features of cancers, is that they have developed a way to avoid the immune system and avoid immune destruction. So you probably best know the immune system as being the system that fights off bacteria, viruses. And the way this is done, and just to kind of go over some of the basics that Dr. Mihalciu mentioned, is that you have cells within your body that detect these foreign viruses and foreign bacteria. They identify the proteins within these viruses and bacteria. And they go to T cells, and they tell the T cells there's an infection. The T cells go, and they find these viruses and proteins, and they eliminate them from the body. But eventually, you want to turn off these T cells. You don't want them continuously functioning. So during evolution, these cells have evolved to have a negative signal that binds to a molecule, CTLA-4, on T cells. And this tells the T cells to turn off, to stop functioning. The immune system has been cleared. Now, as I mentioned, one of the lesser well-known aspects of the immune system is that it also detects cancer cells, not just viruses and bacteria. It also detects cancer cells. And what James Allison did, a basic science researcher who's now at MD Anderson Cancer Center, he was studying exactly how do these T cells work, just basic biology, basic immunology, trying to understand the signaling that's important for regulating these T cells. And this is a quote I wanted to read from his research article. "So I did what I think any basic scientist should do. occasionally stop and think about the implications of your fundamental findings for application to human disease. It occurred to me that if T cells express CTLA-4 as an off signal, every time they receive on signals generated by T cell receptor, then the T cells would be limited in their ability to mediate anti-tumor responses. If only we could block the negative regulation by CTLA-4, then maybe T cell responses would be sustained long enough to eliminate cancer. So he had this idea that if we stop the off signals on T cells, we could reactivate them to kill immune cells. And so he generated an antibody targeting this negative regulator of T cells called anti-CTLA-4, as probably many of you know it, ipilimumab. And he showed in mice, just these model organisms for the disease, that if you treated these mice with these inhibitors, that you could actually cure them from melanoma. He eventually convinced a pharmaceutical company to develop this drug, anti-CTLA-4, and these are the results from the clinical trial. Now, what you can see is quite a difference from the targeted therapy, where you have this effect early in terms of responses, but eventually patients develop resistance compared to the chemotherapy. But with the anti-CTLA-4, you were getting this long-term durable response. As Dr. Mihalciu showed previously, these patients, up to 10 years, over 20% of them, having long-term survival benefits. So with the targeted therapy, you're getting that initial reaction, tumors are shrinking, but unfortunately, the patients will develop resistance. With immune therapies, less patients are responding, but the ones that do respond are surviving longer. But CTLA-4 isn't just the only T cell or negative signal on T cells. There's also PD-L1. So tumors have found a way to turn off T cells by expressing this protein called PD-L1. It binds to PD-1 and tells the T cells to stop killing it. And this is a way that the tumors evolve so they can bypass immune cell destruction. And this is another off signal. And other antibodies have been generated, and you probably know this as Novumilab and Pembrolizumab. I just say Nivo and Pembro, as these names are quite complicated. But what you saw in these patients is that they had an even better response compared to anti-PD-1 with the single agent Nivo. And the combination is showing even better results. So this brings me to the last point. And I just want to highlight some vignettes of what the research community is still doing in order to combat this disease. So this is a very complicated slide showing a lot of different molecules. The whole point of this slide is there is more molecules than just PD-1 and CTLA-4 on T cells. So there are more negative signals that can be drugged. There's more research that needs to be done to understand basic immunology and its implications for cancer therapy. And this is something that needs to be investigated and is being investigated. There's a number of excellent researchers at McGill, in Montreal area, University de Montréal, number of investigators studying this area. Furthermore, the technology has improved for us to identify driver mutations or mutations in cancer. So as I mentioned before with the Sanger sequencing, which was like riding a tricycle, we now have next-generation sequencing, a very appropriate name, which allows us to catalog all the mutations that are found in the patient very quickly. And so this is like moving from, you know, riding a tricycle to driving a sports car. And so this is the project that Nicole mentioned. And actually, a lot of the sequencing has already been done. So from 2010 to 2017, the NIH, through a joint project with NCI, has decided that they are going to spend a significant number of resources to sequence all tumors to identify all mutations in this disease. And this is something that's already happened and something that we've done for melanoma. And so this was the project that Nicole mentioned. There was over 300 participants from over 90 institutions, 20 tissue source sites, and all the investigators are involved in the analysis. and all the authors that were involved in this study. And we really pooled our forces to identify all the various driver mutations and genetic alterations in cancer. And I won't have time to go through all that type of work, but I just want you to know is now that we know some of the know more of the genetic cause of cancer, we are trying to understand how they function, what role they play in melanoma, and to see if we can develop new drugs to target these genetic alterations. Now, the last portion that I think is very translational in terms of the work that we want to do now, to impact patient health now, is discovery of biomarkers to aid in the clinical management of patients. So we already know that there are a large fraction of patients that do not respond to immune therapy, so checkpoint inhibitors. We know a higher fraction respond to anti-PD-1, and we know that there's this long-term durable response of over 20% with patients treated with anti-CTLA-4. What we don't know are what are the molecular features of patients that respond to anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1. Now, I say we don't know, but we're starting to. There's a lot of research groups that are trying to answer this question. Do these melanomas have the same features, the ones that respond to anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1? In other words, if you were to give a patient anti-PD-1, would they similarly respond to anti-CTLA-4? And the reason that we want to know these questions is it's important because we want to know whether you want to give a patient monotherapy or combination therapy, because the combination therapy is a lot more toxic. And can we use this information to help inform on the order of giving treatments to patients? When do we switch off targeted therapy? When do we give immune therapy? And so these are the questions we want to address. And this is very important because these immune therapies have their own sort of side effects. There was an article in the New York Times discussing this fact. So if we can identify biomarkers to help clinicians in terms of aiding them in treatment decision-makings, whether you give monotherapy, whether you give the combination therapy to provide a risk-reward benefit of side effects, that is something that we're trying to do now, and that's something we're trying to do in the melanoma community. So just as a summary of what we're trying to do, with the targeted therapies, what we see is we see this initial response, but eventually patients develop resistance. With immune therapies, we get the patients with long-term durable response, but we still have not enough patients responding. And so our goal is to come up with treatments to produce long-term durable responses in the majority of patients. And the way we're doing this is understanding why some patients respond, some don't, in order to better tailor therapies and to discover new therapies through basic melanoma research in the fields of genetics, molecular biology, immunology, all these areas. And so these are some of the collaborations we've established in Canada, specifically in the Montreal area, to try to address some of these questions. Dr. Teresa Petrella from Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center has been an excellent collaborator, and so we're trying to address these questions. As Nicole mentioned, I started my lab a year and a half ago. I've been very lucky to receive support from the Goodman Cancer Center and the Goodman family, as well as some of these melanoma-specific research funding agencies, including the Melanoma Research Alliance in the U.S. I appreciate your time and just let you know that we are doing our best to try to find new therapies for melanoma.
So now you've heard from the clinicians and scientists who actually are pushing the frontiers back in treating patients. But then there's the other side of the coin. There's the patients who actually undergo these treatments and try to understand what's happening to them and go through the gruesome everyday challenge of fighting off the disease and maintaining somewhat of a normal life. We have tonight such a patient with us. Stan Sherbrooke is a patient of Dr. Mihail Chu. He's been treated for a number of years to combat what has now become metastatic melanoma, and he's going to tell us about his journey. Stan?
Thank you very much. You'll be happy to know that I have one slide, but it's a doozy, I will tell you that. My name is Stan. You can call me Stash, you can call me Stashu, you can call me Stashik, and you can call me Big Sky. So you can call me whatever you want later on when we have the question and answers. I'm going to do this presentation, and I'm going to just provide you with my history, my cancer history, in chronological order. So in 2009, I was diagnosed with cancer, and actually I had my wife, who contacted me by phone as I was hiking in Scotland and had just finished hiking Ben Lomond in Scotland. And that's when I first found out that I had cancer. So in 2009, I came back to Montreal, and I had melanoma, and what I had was a large blotch here on my ear. So my first operation was basically remove my earlobe, or that portion of my earlobe, and that happened in 2009, and it happened the second time in 2011 as well. Now, in 2009, it was basically my cancer was handled by the local doctors at St. Mary's Hospital, more or less, it was also determined that through a college of doctors that basically reviewed my case and said, you know what? You have something in your lungs, but it's sarcoidosis. I had a biopsy done, and basically they found out that, yes, it was sarcoidosis. So I did have to concern myself with sarcoidosis at the time, but they were concerned about my health and basically that I may eventually get cancer. In 2003, and basically every year, I would go to for CT scans to check out my lungs. And in 2013, it was determined that I did have cancer, and I did have cancer in my lungs. And so, therefore, it had metastasized from my ear into my lungs. And at that point, I joined Dr. Mihashu's clinic, and basically became a patient of Dr. Mihashu. So in 2013, I had my first treatment, and I was on a Bristol-Myers double-blind trial, and I received dacarbazine. And I had dacarbazine for about 6 months, and about 3 months. Three or four months, and dacarbazine is basically a chemotherapy. So that's the first treatment that I had, was a chemotherapy. Clearly, it did not work. I then moved in 2014 to a product also by Bristol-Myers called Yervoy, which is an IPI drug, and was on that for a period of about 2 or 3 months as well. And I was going to, at that point, move right into another treatment. So I've already gone through two treatments. But I guess it was October 2014, it was determined that not only did I have some cancer in my lungs, but I also had some cancer in my head. So I had, and basically it's not in the lobe, but basically flowing around the melangine. Is that the problem? Anyway, what little, most of this is Greek to me, by the way, so, but I'll move on. And basically, I had my first major surgery, and I had a couple of whatever it is going into the lung to see what was in there, as well as the tube removal in there, but then this is what happened. I had a craniotomy. Now, this may look bad. Strangely enough, it doesn't hurt. It's not as bad as may look. And that one is my first surgery. And that is 54 staples. It's not even stitches. They're staples because your skull is so hard. And basically, they just cut open the skull, removed the skull, which is actually quite thick, wedged it out, and did a wedge cut, and basically removed the two very large tumors. And the reason that was done is because both my tumors were approximately 2 by 4 centimeters big. So they were large tumors. And they were subsequently removed, and then put that on, a little bit of glue, put that on, back on, and then bang. A couple of plates and some titanium screws. Thank you very much. Life is good. All right? And so I was to move to the next drug at that point, but in roughly May or June of 2015, it was determined that I had two more tumors, except on the other side of the head. So I had the same surgery as this one here, and you can see it because I got a little bit of a scar here that runs all the way over this way. This is 54 staples. The other side is 63 staples. So large, once again, doesn't hurt. The biggest challenge I had was, you can see some puffiness in the eyes. Couldn't watch TV, could listen to TV, couldn't go on the internet, and couldn't read and do a couple of other things because basically your vision is impaired somewhat. So that is mainly the major challenge behind having surgery of that nature. Outside of that, it didn't hurt. Biggest challenge I had, by far, was how not to show that in public. So at the time I wasn't working, going to a library. Don't want to scare the little kiddies, eh? So got to wear a cap. Got to wear a cap when you do that. Going into a supermarket, wear a cap, and I have basically one of those spandex caps that you wear. It's a very nice little cap. And I wore that for a considerable amount of time. So you just get used to the new environment and whatever else. So now this is now 2015, and I'm waiting for my next treatment. And my next treatment at that point was, at the latter part of 2015, was from Bristol-Myers once again, and the original double-blind trial. I received the drug called, Nivolumab, that's the technical term, Nivo or Opdivo, which is the commercial name for it. And I had that drug for approximately two or three months, and kept working on that. And in 2016, and that, by the way, the Nivolumab was my third treatment. And in 2016, in July 2016, a drug produced by Merck, basically, I guess it's, eh? I call it Pembro anyway, or Keytruda, which is the same drug that basically has cured Jimmy Carter in the U.S. I don't know if you remember during the convention they were talking about him being cured of his cancer, and that's what basically I was given, and I'm currently on that. So it's getting very close to a year now. I've had about 10 months worth of Keytruda treatments, and fortunately, the tumors in my lungs are now gone, and through all the operations, the tumors or any tumor in my head is now also gone, however, 5 new tumors have showed up, and those are located in my chest. And they're about the size of a nickel, and they're currently being treated. And I'm going to see how far, and a CT scan will take place in July. I believe it's July 28th. I have a CT scan, and by that, about 10 days after that, I'll find out what the status is of my chest, and I'll find out what the next steps are in terms of where do I go from there in terms of continuing with the Keytruda, or where do I go. So 4 different the chemotherapy is not an immunotherapy drug, but three immunotherapy drugs. And speaking as a patient and one who's currently involved in this and will continue to be involved in this, I just want to make sure that I tell everybody, and for those of you that are patients out there, my motto is, I want empathy, I don't want sympathy. In other words, tell me I look good. Tell me I'm walking. Tell me, you know what, you look great and whatever else. But I don't want the sympathy. I don't want, oh, I'm sorry it happened to you. Oh, it couldn't happen to a better guy or a worse guy, whatever you want to call it. But basically, and that's what I live for, to basically have people come up to me and say, yeah, you're doing a good job. Yeah, you're looking okay for what you look like anyway. But and basically, I think a lot of cancer patients are in that boat because sympathy doesn't do us anything. It just makes us sad again. Empathy makes us feel good. So that's my story, and that's it for me.
Okay, I would ask the speakers to step up to the table, and if you have any questions, please write them on the cue cards. We'll be collecting the cue cards in a minute. The speakers are being offered a small token of our appreciation for the evening. We are, we've been offering all year the famous cookbook that was produced by the Cancer Center and is still quite popular. Okay. So we'll have a first question already while the others are being collected. Could be maybe Dr. Van Kempen or Kathleen. Are warts associated with melanocytes?
Warts? No.
Are warts associated with melanocytes?
No, they're not.
So if you're being treated with immunotherapy, wouldn't this decrease resistance to virus and bacteria?
So when you treat with a checkpoint inhibitor, basically what you do, you maintain the immune system, the T-cell mediated immune system activated. If you treat with interferon, patients who are on interferon, they are protected from viral infection. But patients who are on checkpoint inhibitor, they can get bacterial infection. Sometimes one of the side effects from autoimmune disease is decreasing the white count, but in general, you don't have an impact one way or the other regarding propensity for bacterial and viral infection with checkpoint inhibitors.
Okay. Can a mole turn into a melanoma?
Absolutely. Yes. It's about, I think it's a 1 in 10,000 chance. Yes.
Sorry.
So not every mole develops into a melanoma. We have melanomas without moles, but there are definitely moles with a melanoma. And that's why this ABCDE rule is so important.
So that was the next question. If so, do you know when it does?
Yes. So A, asymmetry, B, borders, C, color, D, E, evolution. D is diameter, and E is?
Evolution.
Et voilà, merci.
Okay, what causes loss of pigmentation?
Usually those are immune response-associated reactions. So when we have a strong immune response, and most of the therapies that are very effective against cells that produce melanin, melanomas, they also attack melanocytes. So it's the same type of recognition molecule that they use, and then the immune system does not discriminate. It just attacks everything that expresses a molecule on that either melanoma cell or melanocyte. And then you lost your depigmentation of your lesion. So vitiligo is a common side effect of these type of therapies.
So I didn't have time to go through detail on autoimmune side effects from checkpoint inhibitors, but the most frequent side effect is on the skin, so you can get itchiness or skin rash. And when I hear that, that's the first question I ask the patient, because for me this is a good sign of toxicity, because it means that you have a T cell that recognizes the epithelial cells from the skin. So that's one aspect. I have a few patients that develop vitiligo as well around the area where they had the recurrence in the axillary lymph nodes. So, and she's responding very, very well to immunotherapy. So for me, this kind of vitiligo, depigmentation, skin rash, itchiness are good side effects to have.
Can you comment on nodular melanoma?
I can. Nodular melanoma is one of the histological subtypes that we know in cutaneous melanoma. I only mentioned in my talk about superficial spreading melanoma. That's a melanoma that grows into the epidermis and then first spreads out, basically using the structure of the skin to grow. Nodular melanoma is genetically and histologically completely different. Even though they arise in the same compartment of the skin, nodular melanomas grow like a balloon. They start to expand, and that requires, quite often these tend to be more malignant. They're more rare. They're not as frequent as superficial spreading melanoma, and they have a completely different genetic makeup, meaning other genes are mutated than you'll find in a superficial spreading melanoma. Very good question.
Actually, here's another good question for you, particularly for you, because I know you studied this. Is male melanoma due to greater outside work, such as construction workers or people more exposed to the sun?
There is a whole lot of studies have been done to understand why males with melanoma do so much worse. And they looked at various things. One of the easiest things to look for is what makes men and women different. It's not just physical activity outside, working, construction outside, but also the hormones, right? Female hormones could be an explanation why those tumors behave differently. Many studies have been performed like that, and that's not the case. But there does, if there's a hormonal influence, it's very, very small. Larger studies have then been performed to understand males just go, or men, just don't go to the doctor and stay with their skin lesions at home, hide them underneath their T-shirts, and only take them off when there is no light. So there have been large studies done to see, is there a relation between working outside on the field, going to your general practitioner, and so that those lesions in females don't happen that often because they're not so often exposed to the sun, and they go more often to the doctor. Also, that is not true. One of my studies favorite study subject is trying to understand why women do so much better. And to make a very long story short, is that females have two X chromosomes, males have an X and an Y, and that's where the difference is. You know, on those two chromosomes, there are genes in there that contribute to better survival for melanomas and males. And it's not only melanomas, it's in most disease. In most diseases, women have an advantage. So my question is, what's the strongest sex? My question is, why are women so much stronger than men?
There's lots of reasons.
I have a question too for him. I showed a slide with Y chromosome in females, so stem cells from fetus that persist for many years, which is a continuous stimulation of the immune system, and maybe why females are more prone to primary biliary cirrhosis, for instance. But continuous immune stimulation, you have a better immune surveillance that might play a role as well. The immune system is more active. Yeah.
Okay, here's one very important question. Where exactly does one draw the line between healthy exposure to sunshine versus harmful exposure to UV rays?
You know, that's difficult. But there are some guidelines. You don't go sunbathing at the height of the afternoon. Right? You avoid sun exposure when the sun is in the top. And there are some interesting tools you can get. I know, for example, of braces. You know, braces that you can wear and that change color as soon as a certain amount of UV has hit your body. And that should be a signal to get out. And it's very difficult because UV exposure is not the same throughout the year, right? It's actually very strong just before summer. And it has everything to do with the ozone layer thickness, right? You remember ozone hole? Ozone is the best UV blocker that we have. And the ozone layer thickens over time. And it's smallest in winter, and then starts to grow over time. But when the sun starts to hit in June, July, that's where you are hit the most with UV. So there are some tools, but the most important thing is that if you go out, wear long sleeves, don't put your kid in a swimming pool with just a bikini shorts, so whatsoever. No, wear long sleeves.
So other than sunscreen, long sleeve shirts, caps for the men?
Yeah. Okay. Especially if you have no hair.
And this this is more from a basic science perspective from the last conference I went to, so maybe it's not as knowledgeable to the general community. There was a study done on mice where they tested different sunscreen companies to see if there was any difference. And the one factor they found that was the best indication, first they showed that sunscreen protects against melanoma, so everyone wear sunscreen. But the biggest variable was the application. So poor application was associated with developing more melanoma versus being more generous with the application. So that's a key factor in terms of getting protection from the sun is the application of the sunscreen, not necessarily the brand.
And it's probably obvious to this crowd, but you avoid tanning salons, huh? The young generation for sure. Mr. Stan, you have a question. What were the symptoms of your ear cancer, or all your various cancers? Did you know they were coming?
First of all, I just wanted to add something as well about the males. Males play softball, ball hockey, golf, and whatever else. So watch your males out there, because they're not only out there for work, or if they do work in an office, they're also biking, they're hiking, and they're jogging. So there's a lot of areas where they can actually get hit with the sun somewhere. In terms of, it's funny you should ask, because when I went to the dermatologist, I had this
what looked like a piece of acne on my ear. And I had just gone on a business trip to Hong Kong and China in 2008 and basically developed this acne of some sort. So when I went to the dermatologist at that time, he basically said, you probably got bitten by something in Hong Kong when you were there. So he cauterized it. I think that's the proper term. He cauterized it and basically sent the sample to McGill, at which point it was identified as being cancer. So that's how I found out about it. And everything now is basically through CT scans, PET scans, MRIs, and everything through Dr. Mihashu's group. That's how I now find out about my cancer.
I think the most important thing is to know your own body, right? You should look at your own body. And if you cannot, of course, you cannot look at your own back. And the mirror is not very helpful. Just ask your partner or your good friend to regularly check if you have nothing weird growing. Because the best cure is to get them very early.
Exactly. Oh, and just to add that, to that, when I was in Vegas a couple of years ago, basically bought a cap that you would buy for your children, which is a baseball cap that also had all flaps on all four sides. And I wear that for biking, and I wear that on a regular basis, as well as I now have a Tilly hat. So I always, as much as possible, wear a hat and wear my little spandex hat whenever I have an opportunity. So it's important just to remind your males that, you know, hey, wear a hat. You know, get a good baseball cap. Get the, you know, the Montreal Canadiens or the Canadian Olympic team or whatever else. There's lots of great hats out there. You can protect your head well enough.
Catherine, could you comment on, I think you mentioned that the combination approach had more toxicity. Can you give us a little bit of a feedback on how different this is from mono?
Yeah, so there is a study that has presented recently in April the results on survival. There are three arms in the study. One is a combination EP-NIVO, the second is NIVO alone, and the third is EP. So when you look at disease-free survival, there is significant separation between the three arms. With NIVO alone or the combination, which are comparable. For overall survival, there is no statistical significance between NIVO alone versus a combination. The only difference is toxicity. And toxicity is, I would call it brutal. If you start a patient on the combination, you don't go on vacation, you stay put. Because 95% of the patients will develop toxicity and 56% will develop significant grade 3 and 4 toxicity. So those patients will most likely end up in the hospital with sequential autoimmune disease, different organs, GI tract, skin or thyroid system. So toxicity is significant. The question is, who are the patients who would benefit only from a single agent, PD-1 inhibitor, which is nivolumab? And that's a big debate that we have right now. Patients who have the study built in stratification for PD-L1 expression, which is a ligand that is produced by the tumor cell to protect itself from the attack of activated T cells. So if they have expressed PD-L1, then those patients do not need the combination because the NIVO curve will superimpose on the combination curve, so they will do equally better. The challenge we have right now is to accurately identify PD-L1 expression. There are some technical issues, but this will be sorted out in the near future.
Okay. Can doctors tell by just looking whether the mole is benign or not.
Dermatologists are getting good at that. Dermatologists have tools to look, already look underneath the skin. So there are some new level of scopes, basically, that they can put on the skin and look what's underneath. And what you can see in those scopes, you can see different patterns, and those patterns are associated with malignant or benign character of the lesions. And so we are getting better at earlier and earlier detection. But the proof of the pudding is still the pathology, where the lesion is taken out, and where we look at the histological level whether this is actually a mole. It's a dysplastic nevus, or a nevus that does not, is not really malignant, but also not really normal, or if it was in a stage of a tumor. But we are getting less and less because the dermatologist is much better in identifying the lesions that are actually at risk of being a melanoma.
Stan, there's a question for you. Someone wants to know comments on your positive attitude, and they want to know whether you've always had a positive attitude or did you develop it in fighting the disease.
I've always had a positive attitude, and I basically have realized that you can't do anything. If you feel sorry for yourself or you feel, you know, whatever, just feeling bad or feeling sad isn't going to help you at all. So you want to cure your cancer, you got to stay healthy. So stay positive. I walk. I no longer work. I'm retired. I walk 40 minutes three times a day in the Mount Royal or in the Outremont Forest. Today I walked about 3 hours before coming here, and basically I know I gotta stay as healthy as possible in order to battle cancer, because I'm in a battle with cancer, and I know being positive and being, you know, making sure that I'm healthy and positive will help me as opposed to being sympathetic of my cause.
That's it. Also, I want to add to that that my advice to the patients is to be in good shape, to avoid stress, because any stress or feeling tired, this is a reflection on the immune system. So you have to really focus on your immune system, try to keep it upbeat. Also, it's important to have a positive attitude from the physician as well.
Here's a good question. If you've had chemo and radiation, are you more prone to melanoma or skin cancer in the long run?
So chemotherapy per se now is not a risk factor for increasing the risk for melanoma. Radiation therapy, yes, it can happen, especially if in the radiation field you have moles. And also if you had exposure, sunburns in the past as a child, or if you went to tanning saloons excessively, yes, you have increased. It's a cumulative risk.
Maybe, not everybody may realize, but melanoma can also be a hereditary disease, right? So you can have mutations in your germline DNA that's present in every single cell that put you at risk for developing of melanoma. So that is independent of UV, right? It's just there. And what you then also often see is that patients that have that type of tumor also quite often have thyroid cancer. So those thyroid cancer and those melanomas, they have something in common that we absolutely do not know yet in detail what makes that tumor grow in a thyroid as well as in the melanoma. So UV is one aspect, hereditary is the second one.
Does the new immunotherapy work on different types of melanoma, such as leptomelanoma and Bowen's disease?
You mean leptomeningeal? I think it's leptomeningeal and bone metastasis. So the inclusion criteria for clinical trials with immunotherapy, the majority of patients will be patients who had cutaneous melanoma, but patients with mucosal melanoma are not excluded. Patients with brain mets are not excluded. Patients with uveal melanoma in some clinical trials are excluded. For uveal melanoma, it's a challenge right now for us in terms of immunotherapy. We didn't find the right algorithm for treating this subtype of melanoma, but I assume in the next few years we'll find some specific mutations that can be targeted.
And desmoplastic melanoma? Are they also responding well? Sure. Desmoplastic melanoma?
Yeah, desmoplastic melanoma too, yeah.
Okay, I want you to join me in thanking our speakers for tonight. As I said before, this is the last in the series for this year. We are currently preparing the series for next year, and there is an online survey. So if you want to tell us what you want to hear, please do so very quickly, because we need your input to organize this. It is almost a quarter to nine. This is Montreal's birthday, 375th. They're going to be, the bridge is going to be illuminated tonight, so as you're going down the hill, you probably might see it. So be careful looking at where you're stepping. In this neighborhood, it's construction all over, so you wouldn't want to fall. I want to thank all the volunteers all year who've been helping us, and I hope to see you again next year. Thank you very much.